Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, and you're listening to the webcast version. And with me in the studio is Dr. Peter Plofton, an astronomer from Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by again, Peter.
Great to be back, Dave.
So in the studio version, the air version of the show, we started talking a little bit about planetary formation and the process by which that's done. So we're going to go into that in greater depth and detail now. So we're going to start off at the very beginning. What's the most important thing when you start off a planetary system that you need to know if you were modeling that or looking at that? Is it how much material is in the system to begin with, or what kinds of things might you be interested in?
Well, you definitely have to start with the star first. And as the star forms, the material that's left over from the formation of the star settles into a spinning disk. And you can see a wide variety of masses of these disks. So we have something in astronomy called a minimum mass solar nebula, which is how much gas and dust you need to make our present day solar system. And so when we observe disks around other stars, young baby stars in the process of forming, we know these disks range in size from less than a minimum mass solar system, meaning they couldn't make our solar system if we gave it enough time, to tens of times the mass we see in our solar system.
And so if you were to look at that, you say we first need a star. And so the stars form from this initial cloud, and then it starts to spin, as you talked about, or there's already spinning going on. So where does the spin come from? Is there angular momentum, as it were, in the cloud to begin with? Is that what's at work here?
That's right. It's purely from the conservation of angular momentum. So as the initial cloud of dust and gas that the star forms from contracts under the force of gravity faster than the heat can radiate away, before it doesn't get hot enough for it to halt that collapse, as it shrinks down, it starts spinning faster and faster, just like a figure skater pulling in their arms as they go into a spin.
Right. And then from that, you're going to get a number of planets. Now, you talked about the minimum mass that could create our solar system. So what would happen if a solar system that you're looking at, or a disk you're looking at, had less than our minimum mass? Would it form a solar system with just fewer planets, or would it not form a solar system at all?
Well, the planets generally be smaller. So it's still possible to form planets, but the rate at which you can make a planet depends on the amount of material you have from which to draw. So if you have less mass, it's going to take longer to make that planet, and as a result, it's not going to be as massive. So particularly if it's taking a lot longer, the gas in that star system is going to be gone after about 4.5 million years. And so you might not be able to make gas giants in time. It might only end up with terrestrial planets.
Right. Now let's discuss that a little bit further as far as the number of planets we have. So we have 8, 9, whatever you want to call it. What dictates the number of planets you might get? Can you know that from the amount of mass you have, or could it be all over the map?
So generally speaking, we have something called the feeding zone, which a more technical term might be the Hill radius, which is basically the sphere of influence around which a planet dictates the gravitational dynamics of the gas and dust around this forming planet. So you can generally, what we found from, say, the Kepler mission and other studies of planets around other stars are that planetary systems are relatively tightly packed, meaning that if there's a gap between two planets and dynamically there's room in there for another planet to exist, it probably does.
And does that mean when you go out looking for planets that influences the statistics that you might find?
To some extent, yes. Generally speaking, we find that most planetary systems are dynamically filled, meaning that if you try to squeeze an extra planet in between the two other ones, it would dynamically be ejected, so it's not stable.
Now, is that likely to have happened in the early solar system that we live in? Is it possible there were additional bodies in the solar system that at one time or another were truly ejected from it?
Yeah, so we call that the oligarch era of planetary growth. When new planetary systems are born, they start from these small pebble, the dust eventually grows into pebble sized kind of centimeter diameter solid particles, and then those accrete into kilometer sized, we call those parent bodies, and then they grow into the thousands of kilometer sized planets that we know today. And during that process, you're going from a huge number of small things to a small number of big things, aka planets. And so in that process, it's thought that over 90% of some of that material, some of those oligarch protoplanets, can get ejected because it's just not dynamically stable, leaving you with the ones that are.
One thing I forgot to ask you, when you talk about the mass that you had to start with, how much of the mass of the solar system typically is going to be in the star versus how much of the mass is in the planet?
So over 99% of the mass of our solar system is in our sun. It's over 300,000 times the mass of the Earth. By comparison, Jupiter, which is the biggest planet in our solar system, has 1/1000th, 0.1% of the mass of our sun. So we're just talking about the tiniest amount, less than 0.2% of the leftovers of the mass that went into making our star. That's what the stuff that planets are made of.
So let's talk a little bit about how you're looking at extrasolar planets. One of the things, as a condensed matter physicist, we can go into a lab and make something and kind of dictate what we're going to study. But you guys have to actually look out there and try to find representative samples that you can study to sort of piece together a history of how a solar system could form. So how do you go about trying to do that?
Well, there are a lot of ways of answering that question. One thing we can do is build up a comprehensive snapshot of mature planetary systems, you know, planetary systems orbiting stars that are similar in age to our sun, you know, 5 billion years or so old. One of the challenges going forward is connecting our observational evidence of these disks of debris where we know planets are forming to these mature planetary systems. How do we go from what we know we start with to what we have around mature stars? So one of the scientific areas I'm involved in is looking for planets around young stars, where we might gain some clues in the first 50 million years of a star's life as to how the statistics and demographics of these populations of exoplanets are changing with time. But that's a pretty new field. In fact, there's only been a handful of planets, I'd say less than a dozen, that are known to orbit stars that are less than 100 million years old.
Now, I mean, the time scales you're talking about here, a sun might have a stable planetary system for what percentage of its whole lifetime? 90% of its whole lifetime it has a stable planetary system or something like that?
Well, the star itself is going to be stable for on that order of its life. The planetary system itself should be stable on a similar time scale, but again, it depends on the particulars of the planetary system you're talking about, right? So whether or not it has a hot Jupiter, so to speak, whether or not it's dynamically packed, whether or not some of these planets have been caught in what we call that resonance, where for every two times, one planet goes around, another planet goes around once. That's something we call a resonance. Another interesting question to consider with the Kepler Space Telescope is we found planetary systems with up to 5 planets orbiting within the orbit of Mercury in our solar system. We call these compact multis. There's nothing like that in our solar system. Mercury is the closest one to our sun. So a big dynamical question is, why didn't our sun end up with planets like that? Or conversely, why do those stars have planets that orbit interior to the orbit of Mercury for our own sun?
So let's talk about that a little bit. The idea that you can find those easily is obviously not true, and so therefore a lot of modeling must be done. So if somebody were to look at that, what is the general thought right now, that planets many times form further out and then they wander their way into this interior region where they're closer than Mercury would be? Is that typically what's thought of?
So again, it depends on the type of planet you're talking about. So for the hot Jupiters, so these are planets that range in mass from maybe half the mass of Jupiter up to 10 to even 30 times the mass of our Jupiter, that orbit their star once every few days, you know, compared to Jupiter, which is going around over a decade. And it's thought that those planets must form further out and either get scattered in by one of these oligarchs or migrate in because of a nearby passing star disturbing its orbit, or potentially migrating when the star is still very young and there's still gas present in the disk. So maybe this planet forms and moves very close to its star only within a few million years. And so astronomers are looking for these so-called smoking guns, these young planetary systems where they're caught in this act of migrating. And maybe we'll have the answer to that observationally in our lifetimes. I hope so. But we don't have that answer as of today.
What kind of an orbit would that look like? I mean, typically we think of orbits as being ellipses, some form of an ellipse. Would that be some sort of a non-closed ellipse? Would it get perturbed into an ellipse by the time it got in, or how would that work?
So in the case of a nearby star, say, perturbing the orbit of Jupiter to make it into a hot Jupiter, which, by the way, exists in only about 1% of stars like the Sun that we see those type of hot Jupiters. So they're pretty rare, but they're easy to find, so we know of a lot of them. In that case, with a nearby star perturbing its orbit, what it'll do is actually drive it to a highly eccentric orbit, so a very elongated orbit, so that it gets close enough to the star for another force to take over, in this case the tidal forces from the star, to drain that orbit so that it ends up in a very close orbit. So astronomers are looking for those highly elongated orbits, and they don't seem to be there. But it's an open-ended question, and we don't quite have the answer. But another thing is, if it's moving in the disk, then you can think of it like a slowly inspiraling planet, where it looks circular on an instantaneous snapshot, but over time it's just getting closer and closer to the star.
When you talk about these really elongated orbits, you're talking about something that we would think of looks like a comet, looks like at some level.
That's right. In our solar system, pretty much most of the planets have nearly circular orbits, almost perfectly round. You know, Mars and Pluto, they have some of the more elongated orbits, but by eye, you could barely tell they're not circles. The only things in our solar system that have really elongated orbits are the comets and some asteroids. But we have found for planets around other stars, particularly more massive Jupiter planets, that they can have quite elongated orbits, unlike anything in our solar system.
If a comet ever did this thing that you're talking about going close, is it possible that its orbit could be circularized, or is that impossible because of how eccentric it is?
Well, it's related to something we call the tidal circularization timescale, how quickly that tidal force can affect the orbit of that comet. But yeah, you can collide the comet with the Sun, for example, and that's happened. But you can alter the orbit, but the main driver of altering the orbits of comets is actually the mass that's lost from the comets as they're heated up, as they dive in towards the Sun.
Right, right. So you've got these solar systems you're looking at, and we talked a little bit about this once when you first came by, and let's talk about it a little bit more. There's a snapshot out there, and the snapshot right now has a bias in it. So talk a little bit about how there's a bias in what you're looking at when you look at the extrasolar planets and how you're able to look past that. The discussion about a bias towards observing certain kinds of planets, bigger planets and things like that.
Yeah, so right now we find planets more easily when they're bigger and when they're closer to their star. So what astronomers spend a lot of time arguing about is actually how to correct for those effects. What we're really interested in knowing right now, the big question, is how common are Earth-sized planets at roughly the same distance from their star as our own Earth is from our Sun, so that if that planet had water on its surface, it could be liquid and capable of supporting life. But right now, the two most successful planet-finding techniques aren't quite sensitive enough to find those analogs, those Earth twins. So there's some amount of extrapolation from bigger planets out of those orbits and then from Earth-sized planets closer in to their stars. And we've nailed down the number to somewhere around 1 in 10 Sun-like stars have Earth-sized planets at the right distance from their stars. But it could be 1 in 20, it could be 3 in 10. We're still trying to figure out the exact number.
You talked a little bit about looking for solar systems around young stars. That's one of the things you're interested in. Is it possible that in a young star, any of the planets could be in a Goldilocks zone, so to speak, yet, or is that too early on?
At that point, the Sun is, or the star is still cooling off. It's still contracting from its formation. So the Goldilocks zone, the habitable zone, where there could be surface liquid water, will be further out than where it'll eventually be. So it's a little too early and premature. We're talking on life or potential for life or supporting life on those planets. We have to give them some time to cool off.
So talk a little bit about the next step. We talked about this once before. We're further along now. What's the next big project that people will be using to try to find other solar systems? Is that the James Webb, or what is that going to be?
In terms of forming planets, one of the main missions going on right now is not a visible telescope at all. It's called ALMA. And it's actually focusing on mapping the disk structures in these systems when there's still dust and gas around them, and looking for signatures of these baby planets around them by the impact they have on the shape of those disks, like creating little ripples and waves. That's one area people are actively working on. Another area that people are working on are around the mature stars, because once the stars mature, it's quiet, it's well-behaved, it doesn't change as much in terms of brightness and temperature. And so for those stars, the next mission that's dedicated to finding planets around those stars is a Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, which will launch, and the current launch date is no earlier than December of 2017, which is about a year and a half away. And that mission is going to look at 250,000 of the nearest stars to look for when and if they have planets passing in front of those stars with respect to our line of sight, like an eclipse.
So it's going to be a transiting mission, just like
Kepler. Mm-hmm. But Kepler technology was such that it could only look at a relatively small patch of the sky. Now I say small, but it was huge compared to anything that ever been done before. But the test mission is taking that. So as a result, the Kepler mission had to look very far away. So stars that were a kiloparsec, you know, what we say about 3,300 light years. For the test mission, it's looking over the entire sky. And so it's going to be looking at the nearest stars. We're talking stars that are less than 300 light years away. And it's going to find the closest transiting planets. And some of them, particularly around the cooler stars, may be at the right temperature to support liquid surface water. And when the James Webb Space Telescope launches in 2018, we're going to attempt to take spectra of them to see what their atmospheres are composed of. But it'll be a very challenging signal to detect.
When you talk about this test mission, that's going to be a data-rich mission. So do they have some sort of a completely automated technique by which they will crunch every bit of this? Or will they have to parse this data out to teams who will look for the signatures for the planets in them?
So part of it will be processed on NASA supercomputers. And part of it will be automated. In fact, one of the things that came out of the Kepler mission was some machine learning-based tools to take a look at the brightness of a star as a function of time and determine whether or not it had planets passing in front of that star. And so for the most part, that process is now completely automated, but nonetheless, expert astronomers who are used to looking at this data can still beat out some of the best computer algorithms out there. And also, even amateurs sometimes find things that the machines miss.
Right. Well, Peter, thanks very much for stopping by and talking again about planet formation, and we appreciate you coming by.
Happy to be on the show.
Once again, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you're listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.